loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we talk about five big stories. First, in a blow to immigrant rights and basic civil liberties, the Supreme Court has ruled 5-3 to restrict the right of immigrants held in detention centers, limiting their right to bail hearings and making it easier for authorities to detain them indefinitely for years. Next, we turn to the issue of nuclear power. The anti-nuclear group Beyond Nuclear took its fight to the Supreme Court on Monday with a rare petition asking the justices to require federal regulators to change rules that exclude nuclear power plant transmission lines from environmental review. The petition marks the first time the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decision to allow expedited construction of a new power plant is being challenged inside the Supreme Court. Then, a debate has erupted over the effectiveness of the Trump and Clinton campaign's social media operations during the 2016 election. But how does social media advertising work, and what is its impact on democracy? Next, President Trump blasted his Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Twitter this morning, saying that Sessions' decision to simply refer a FISA investigation to the Justice Department's Inspector General was, in his words, disgraceful. Also, The Atlantic has released private messages between WikiLeaks and Roger Stone, where WikiLeaks is clearly telling Roger Stone, stop saying that you're associated with WikiLeaks since you are not. And finally, the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. We're going to talk about what's going on in the Congo with the war in the East and the role of Uganda, Rwanda, and of course, the United States. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, in a blow to immigrant rights and basic civil liberties, the Supreme Court on Tuesday said those held by the government and facing deportation are not entitled to a bond hearing even after years of detention. We are joined from Philadelphia by Miguel Andrade. He is a communications manager at the immigrant rights advocacy organization Juntos, and he's also a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And we're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barron, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Both of you, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Jorge, let's begin with you. I mean, when I read this case, I mean, even Justice Breyer read his dissent out loud. That only happens when a justice is completely outraged. But this is outrageous. This means indefinite detention is now okay, or the law of the land inside the United States of America. Do you read it that way?
Well, we're still hoping that that we can fight back against this. The court left open a window to continue fighting back against indefinite detention. But the reality is that the way that the immigration detention system is structured, people are left. So many people have no legal representation, and the challenge with this is that instead of being able to kind of quickly ask for a bond hearing, the way that we'll be able to challenge this is to filing individual federal court cases, which is going to make it very difficult for people. So while legally speaking, there are still challenges available, as a practical matter, it is going to, you know, for a lot of people mean that they're going to be stuck in immigration detention for much longer than was the case before this court decision came down.
Miguel, the case was brought by Alejandro Rodriguez. He was a lawful permanent resident who came to the country as an infant. The Department of Homeland Security had started removal proceedings against him because of a conviction for drug possession. Rodriguez was working as a dental assistant, was held for 3 years, locked up for 3 years before he challenged his confinement. He has since won the case, but now the Supreme Court, I guess what's happening is overturning the appeals court ruling in his favor. Is that what happened?
I believe so. And I think I just want to take a moment to say that this the
the conversation really isn't about those who, you know, who deserves to be here, who doesn't. Like, this is an attack, once again, that we're seeing from this administration to immigrant communities. Specifically, I mean, we have to point out that this is an attack on Black and Brown communities as well. Like, the being able to have bail hearings was a little bit of a lifeline for a lot of people who go through the detention process. And taking this away just means, like, as you were saying, indefinite detention for a lot of people. And it also serves to increase sort of, like, it's millions of dollars going into the pockets of private prisons who will now be making money off of holding our communities indefinitely.
Very interesting. Let's talk about that, Jorge. I mean, people who are locked up and now locked up indefinitely with this court ruling, they're being held in private prisons and the private prisons are making money. In other words, is there a commercial aspect to this?
I completely agree with Miguel that I think there is a very disturbing, you know, pattern that has developed as the, you know, and this is now, you know, years in the making, but of course it's on steroids under the Trump administration, which is that, you know, the private companies that are profiting from immigration detention are going to benefit even more from this ruling. You know, here in our state, the state attorney general has a lawsuit pending against the GEO Group, which is one of the largest providers of immigration detention, and because they're violating our state minimum wage law by, you know, employing people who are detained at a rate of $1 a day, which, needless to say, is well below our minimum wage here. And so this is just, you know, another example. Now, these people under this court ruling are going to be, you know, held in detention longer. And you know, the impact of this, it's a pattern of trying to get people to give up, you know, claims to be able to stay here with their families. And I think it's just important to note that this is not only impacting the people in detention, but what we see is the impact that it has on the families that are left behind. And so a lot of people have all these ties to the community. And of course, you know, when they get detained, they lose their job. The family doesn't have the support of the individual who's detained. And so the suffering is felt well beyond the immigrant detention centers.
I hear you. Miguel, the case has gotten heightened importance, the Alejandro Rodriguez case. It's gotten heightened attention and importance because of the Trump administration's crackdown, systematic nationwide raids against immigrants and immigrant families. But this case actually started under the Obama administration. It was the Obama administration that actually pursued this policy whereby individuals like Alejandro Rodriguez should not or would not have access to bond or bail hearings and could be locked up for 3 years. As a matter of fact, Justice Kagan, who was appointed by Obama, who had been Solicitor General earlier, had to recuse herself in this case. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, there's no mistaking that, you know, the Obama administration, he earned the moniker Deporter-in-Chief for a reason, right? Like, these are attacks that have been happening to our community for years at this point. It's not a Trump phenomenon. And in fact, I think, you know, a lot of immigrant advocacy orgs and groups during the time of the elections were sort of pushing the Obama administration to limit as much of these sort of tools for these attacks and not hand them over to this administration, because we knew these kinds of attacks were going to sort of, there's going to be an uptick on this, right? So this has been happening for years. Like, the deportation machine has been happening and you know, putting our people through this system for years at this point.
Jorge, what about the court itself? The decision on the case had resulted in a deadlock before Justice Neil Gorsuch joined the court. Talk about the Supreme Court right now. I mean, the makeup is unmistakable. It's demonstrably very hostile to the immigrant community. It's a very, very right-wing court. As a consequence, even when immigrants win at the lower court, at the federal district court, or in this case, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, if the administration can get the Supreme Court to hear the case, it's almost a slam dunk under these circumstances. Or maybe that's too simple. Anyway, what's your view?
Well, I certainly think that it's concerning because I think that the what the court did in this decision is you know, defer to the political branches and to defer to the Congress and the president, and that is quite concerning when there's other cases in the pipeline like the the Muslim ban case, the there could eventually be a case that brings up DACA again. And the court seems to not want to stand up to abuses that are clearly contrary to our constitutional values. You know, that's what Justice Breyer was sort of emphasizing, that in no other context does our country sort of allow for this kind of indefinite detention without a chance, without an opportunity, right? And it's important to remember that, you know, we were not talking about a situation where people are saying like they have to be released after 6 months. They were just asking for a chance to go before a judge and make the case of why they should be released. And so I think this, it is disturbing that the court is not standing up for constitutional principles right now. And, you know, the election, you know, had the result of leading to the deciding vote in this case.
Miguel, we have less than 2 minutes left. A day in court, your right to face your accuser, hearing evidence in open court. These are the hallmarks of what we learn as children, our democracy. But here you have the high court, the highest court of the land, saying you don't have a right to come to court. You don't have a right to face your accuser or hear the evidence. You don't have a right to acquit yourself or be acquitted. It seems to me it's applied to immigrants right now and to, as you said, to black and brown communities. But it has a universal negation of democracy once we cross this threshold. We have 1 minute left. Go ahead. You get the last word.
Yeah, I would just say that this is not only a violation of people's constitutional rights, but in my personal opinion, it's a violation of people's human rights, right? We are talking about holding people indefinitely and not letting them be able to defend themselves. As Jorge was saying, this is not even about being people not only being held indefinitely, but not even being able to make the argument of being able to be released on bail. We're talking about sort of turning our prisons into, you know, internment camps here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you don't have the right to go to court, don't have the right to hear the evidence, face your accuser, possibly get out, these are internment camps, and we might as well just start to call them by their real name, internment camps. We're out of time. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Miguel Andrade. He is the communications manager at the immigrant rights advocacy organization Juntos, and he's also a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And we've been joined from Seattle by Jorge Barran, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The anti-nuclear group Beyond Nuclear took its fight to the Supreme Court on Monday with a rare petition asking the justices to require federal regulators to change rules that exclude nuclear power plants' transmission lines from environmental review. The petition marks the first time the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decision to allow expedited construction of a new power plant is being challenged in the Supreme Court. We're joined from Washington, D.C., in studio by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, thank you for joining.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
This is a big deal. I mean, you're going to the Supreme Court, not very frequent, maybe the first time, in fact. Talk about why this is important, what you intend to do or are doing.
Well, it's an old tradition. The United Auto Workers took the Atomic Energy Commission to the U.S. Supreme Court back in the early 1960s against the same nuclear power plant, and they were proven right a few years later. They lost in the Supreme Court by a 7-2 vote, and that Fermi 1 atomic reactor had a meltdown. So we almost lost Detroit. There's a famous Gil Scott-Heron song about that.
Indeed, there is. It's a great song. We almost lost Detroit. And did we almost lose Detroit?
We sure did. There's a whole book by John G. Fuller called We Almost Lost Detroit, and that's where Gil Scott-Heron took the title. They melted down a part of that core at the Fermi Unit 1. And here we are, a half century or more later, we're fighting Fermi Unit 3, a proposed new reactor, a giant one, that would be built karmically enough, on the exact spot where that meltdown took place. And so we've been fighting this monster for over a decade, trying to stop this new reactor. We've introduced 36 technical contentions, and we have one left. We're holding on with all we've got. And what this has to do with is a major reversal of Nuclear Regulatory Commission policy. So back in the day, in the 1970s, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission used to defend its right to regulate transmission line corridors. The company Detroit Edison back then, on the Fermi Unit 2 reactor, which operates as we speak, they said, NRC, you don't have the right to regulate our transmission lines. NRC back then said, yes, we do, under the National Environmental Policy Act. So along comes 2007, the Bush-Cheney nuclear power renaissance. And guess what? The NRC changed its rules and said, we can build a nuclear power plant and not even worry about the transmission lines. And we've been fighting that rule change for a decade now because it's a major reversal of National Environmental Policy Act policy at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
I mean, the stakes are so high, and I think most Americans don't know and really couldn't know what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does, who's on it. It's not an elected body. They don't run for office. We don't know what they really think or believe. We don't know what their relationship is to the nuclear industry. And yet it wields enormous power, especially if they're going to say at a certain point, guess what? The rules have changed. And these earlier rules that provided some environmental sort of review, at least, are no longer applicable. I mean, why? I mean, it's kind of the dictatorship of a regulatory agency. It sounds benign. It's to regulate, but it actually has all this authority without any sort of accountability.
It's a rogue and captured agency. And this very fight we're in on the transmission line corridor goes back to 2007 when an NRC commissioner, one of the five directors, he was a Republican named Jeffrey Merrifield, and now he works at Shaw Pittman, Pillsbury, in this neighborhood, the lead pro-nuclear law firm in this country. What he did was he orchestrated this rule change, an Orwellian nuke speak rule change that said the definition of the word construction in NRC regulations from now on does not include non-nuclear parts of the nuclear power plant, like the transmission line corridor. They excused themselves from the National Environmental Policy Act. They did not include this in their environmental impact statement. And then, upon retiring from the NRC a few months after the rule change, he went to work for a company called the Shaw Group, which specializes in new reactor construction. And they took full advantage of that rule change to bulldoze in Georgia, in South Carolina, these proposed new reactors that have, in South Carolina, gone belly up at a cost of $9 billion with a B to South Carolina ratepayers who will get nothing in return and have lost $9 billion. And this guy, Jeffrey Merrifield, got $1.2 million a year when he went to work for Shaw Pittman. So that kind of public service is serving the public up for dinner to the nuclear power industry. And he's still at it. He works at this pro-nuke law firm now.
The whole idea of public service, I mean, in fact, turned upside down. It's the opposite of public service.
And it's gutting the National Environmental Policy Act, which is the top environmental law in this country. So specifically at Fermi Unit 3, they're going to bulldoze literally through over 10 miles of intact ecosystem, 300 feet wide. And in there is critical habitat for endangered and threatened species. It's a long list. Just one example is the eastern fox snake, which is a constrictor. I'm from Michigan, and I had no idea we had constrictors in Michigan. Well, they're endangered. They only have pockets of habitat, and this transmission line corridor would blast through that very habitat and perhaps extirpate the species. And that's what the National Environmental Policy Act is supposed to protect against, is that kind of mistake, that kind of bad idea. And they've just thrown it to the wind. They're not doing it.
Help us understand in a technical, what some of the technical terms in non-technical language, what is the function of the transmission line corridor then?
Well, it is the connection to the regional electric grid. And that's why Fermi Unit 3, this giant new reactor, would be built, is to generate massive amounts of electricity to electrify Michigan, at least half of Michigan, Detroit Edison service territory. The other thing that a transmission line corridor does, because it's a circuit, is it brings electricity into the nuclear power plant. So wouldn't you know that the grid is the primary source of electricity for running safety systems and cooling systems at a nuclear power plant? Fukushima Daiichi is the poster child for this. The first thing that was lost at Fukushima Daiichi in 2011 was the grid. It went down in the earthquake. They lost their primary supply of electricity for running safety and cooling systems. All they had left at that point was emergency diesel generators. And guess what? The tsunami that swept in 50 minutes later took those out. They had no electricity now to run safety and cooling systems. That's another aspect of this whole thing, is they're so slipshod at Fermi 3 with this transmission line corridor that there's huge safety risks that they're not dealing with in addition.
So the regulatory reform, again, using language that's just upside down, reform, you usually think of something good, something's been improved, not, you know, made worse. But this regulatory reform in 2007, what the new rule stated was that the transmission line corridor, because it's not nuclear, doesn't fall under the same severe regulatory oversight as the nuclear parts of the nuclear plant. In other words, dissecting the whole and saying, because parts of the whole don't have to do with nuclear power themselves, they're exempt in some ways from the other regulatory supervision.
It's a textbook example of what's called segmentation, which has never been allowed under the National Environmental Policy Act. If you divide a project up into small enough parts, it doesn't look so bad. And the courts, the Supreme Court, has ruled consistently for decades you can't do that. And that's why we hope that there's merit here. And we had the support of the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Their kangaroo court system said our arguments had merit, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commissioners blocked them, said, no way, we're not going to let you review this matter, just go away. They invoked a self-initiative review, which hasn't happened in 15 plus years out there. And the commissioner said, nope, little licensing board, just forget about it. You can't look into this matter.
So in the case of Fukushima, as a consequence of the loss of electricity, the safety and cooling systems in the Fukushima reactor went down. That's what happened.
Yes.
Just because it's, even though it's recent history, people forget, what did happen at Fukushima and what was its impact?
Well, Fukushima was initiated by a massive 9.0 earthquake, followed by a 45-foot tall tsunami that caused the meltdown over a series of just a few days of three reactors. There had never been a multi-reactor meltdown in the history of nuclear power. There had been Chernobyl, there had been Three Mile Island, not three meltdowns in a row in a single week. And what it led to was a massive release of harmful ionizing radioactivity into the environment, into the atmosphere, which then fell as rain and snow in North America just a few days later because of prevailing winds. And to this day is still being released into the ocean, the biggest artificial hazardous radioactivity impact on the oceans of this planet in history.
And in our last minute, is it possible that we could have a Fukushima here?
Absolutely. At the Fermi Nuclear Power Plant, you have Unit 2, which is the biggest Fukushima Daiichi twin design in the world, has tremendous safety risks. They want to add to that with the risks of Unit 3. And if we were to have a Fukushima on the shoreline of the Great Lakes, that's drinking water for 40 million people in eight states, two provinces, and a large number of Native American First Nations. Those are the risks that they're willing to take to make a nasty profit up there.
So the whole Great Lakes region, from Chicago all the way to the eastern part of Lake Ontario, that includes a lot of cities.
And the St. Lawrence River all the way out to the ocean. There are 40 million people that draw their drinking water from that freshwater system.
Well, the stakes couldn't be higher. We encourage our audience to go to beyondnuclear.org, the website that Kevin Camp's organization has put up. Kevin Camp's is the radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The media is covering a big debate which has erupted over the effectiveness of the Trump and Clinton campaign's social media operations during the 2016 election, in particular, the role of Facebook ads. That's one story. And then the second story is, how does social media, and in particular, Facebook advertising, work? How does it really work? And what is its impact on democracy? We are joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Welcome back, Dr. Epstein.
It's my pleasure, Brian.
So let's talk about the story. I mean, the Wired headline caught a lot of attention. The Wired story was picked up in the Washington Post. What was your reaction?
My reaction was, so what? I mean, I don't think there's a story here at all, or at least they're not telling the real story.
Okay, what is the real story?
Well, the real story that we all should be focusing on here is the acknowledgement by the Wired author, who's a former Facebook employee, that both campaigns were using Facebook to try to get the word out in various ways. One of the ways the Trump campaign was using Facebook was to try to suppress the Clinton vote. So in other words, you target Clinton voters and then you send out engaging, and meaning, you know, people are going to click on these stories, engaging but negative stories about Hillary Clinton to keep the voters home. So, but the bottom line is that both campaigns were spending lots of money on Facebook to try to influence the outcome of the election. And that should surprise nobody, since Facebook actually advertises its ability to impact elections. They actually advertise that. They, in other words, they try to attract election campaigns as customers and say, we can help you win. Now, of course, you think about it, that's kind of like arms manufacturers selling weapons to both sides in every war, and Facebook is very happy to do that. Bottom line, which I keep telling people, is that this process is competitive, and we now have more and more evidence that the process is so competitive that it doesn't really have much of an impact on the outcome of an election. It's just like billboards. You know, I put up one on one side of the street, you put up, you know, one for the opponent on the other side of the street, and, you know, whoever can maybe has the money for the biggest billboard, you know, might, you know, get a little edge off of that. But the point is, this process is competitive. Why is that important? You know, and these new stories that have just come out are making it clear how competitive this is, and why is that important? Because with billboards or newspaper ads or television ads or radio ads, all the traditional ads, you know, the process is, there's no middleman, okay, that's kind of deciding what people ultimately see. So, in other words, the process is truly competitive.
Right, and a billboard is a billboard, where if you take out a Facebook ad, if you pay for a Facebook ad, there's other criteria that Facebook is going to be using, the Facebook Corporation is going to be using to see how many people actually see that ad. As opposed to the predictability, say you put a billboard up on I-66, you know how much traffic is going by. You can sort of gauge how many people might see it. Same with a radio ad, same with a TV ad. There's different parts to this story. So this is from the Washington Post. Brad Parscale is at core a digital marketer. Over the course of the 2016, his client was Donald Trump, and Parscale's management of Trump's online advertising efforts were no small part of the presidential candidate's unexpected victory. On Tuesday, Parscale was reportedly named the campaign manager for Trump's 2020 re-election bid, in no small part a reflection of Trump's confidence in his work during 2016. Since the 2016 campaign ended, Parscale has been investing a lot of his digital marketing energy in another client himself. Over the weekend, that meant plugging Wired's extensive look at how Trump campaign effectively used Facebook. And in response to a question posed by Wired editor-in-chief Nick Thompson, a bold claim about how much more effective his campaign ad spending was relative to Hillary Clinton's. I bet, this is Brad Parscale's tweet, I bet we were 100 times to 200 times her. We had CPMs, that's the number of people who are clicking, that were pennies in some cases. That is why @RealDonaldTrump was a perfect candidate for Facebook. Anyway, he's bragging. He's obviously promoting himself. He's promoting the efficacy. But just talk about why Donald Trump using Facebook's algorithm would be a more perfect candidate for Facebook, say, than Hillary Clinton or the Clinton campaign.
Well, yes, on its face, obviously, because Trump is expert at clickbait. He's expert at just saying outrageous things that they're going to get lots of attention. So yeah, on the surface, it looks like the Trump campaign is going to get more mileage and pay less, you know, than the Clinton campaign. But of course, another article that just came out, you know, it has a Facebook representative saying, "No, that's not true. You know, Trump actually paid more." Okay. You know, this is all just, everything here is smoke and mirrors these days. I can't believe any of us can even walk down the street anymore. There's so much smoke around us and so many mirrors. I can't believe we can stand up, frankly. Because for one thing, Facebook is not telling us the amount that was spent by the PACs and the super PACs. And a lot of the money, if not most of the money, but a lot of the money now that's being spent on campaigns is coming from super PACs. They're not telling us anything about that money.
That's an important point.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So we can't really trust their numbers they're showing us. But again, what we've got to focus on is that this process is competitive, but it's not competitive in the old way where you put up billboards or buy radio ads, because you can see, you can hear, you know, what's happening with those ads. The problem with Facebook and Google, for that matter, is that you have an ad spend, you buy some, you know, some Facebook ads, and you don't know after that what's going on, because what's going on after that is determined entirely by Facebook's algorithms. Facebook. So there's a third party here that's never existed before. This is true with Facebook and with Google. In other words, how they decide to connect you with people is completely, totally secret. You have no control over it. You don't know. I mean, you know, there's now clear evidence, for example, that Twitter widely practices something called shadow banning, where you send out a tweet and they decide, well, only 1% of your followers are going to see your tweet. You have no way of knowing what happens, because you don't. These algorithms are secret. They're not transparent. So there's a third party here that is deciding on two things: the filtering, that is what gets selected to show people, and the ordering. That's what my team and I study. We study, you know, what happens when you actually put lists of information in front of people, and we measure very precisely how dramatically you can shift people's opinions. And wow, yes, you can, but all of this is determined by these algorithms. And just no one is talking about this. We're still focusing on the content. The content is competitive, and it doesn't even really matter. All that matters now are the algorithms, which are in the hands of two or three big corporations. And those corporations and their algorithms, they're deciding what people see, and that determines whether votes or opinions are getting shifted.
Yeah, and we only have a minute left, unfortunately. Well, I have thousands of Facebook friends, but when I put up a Facebook post, and I'm regularly active on Facebook, it's the same 40 or 50 or 60 people who are always responding. And then I talk to other people, and they say, oh, you're not active on Facebook, because they actually never see any of the posts. So how does it happen that, and I think this is relatively routine, a lot of people know this to be the case, the same thing that thus with advertising, what people pay for advertising, but there's no given sort of assumption based on a contract that people are going to actually see that advertisement.
That's right. See, if you bought an ad or buy an ad now in the New York Times or something, you can actually go to the newsstand, pick up the print version, or even look online, and you can see your ad. You see, it leaves a paper trail. But that is not true now with these online platforms, and we have no idea what they're doing, and we will not know what they're doing until we set up a big monitoring system of the sort that my team and I developed in 2016 to measure what search results Google, Bing, and Yahoo were showing relevant to the election. And so I'm working with people now in the U.S. and other countries to set up a monitoring system. That's what we've got to have. We've got to be able to see what these companies are actually showing people.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. $81 million, I think, was the official number that the Trump and Clinton campaigns, the official number, spent on Facebook advertising. What it went for and where it went, who saw it, we don't know that. And of course, as Dr. Epstein is saying, there could be the PACs who don't have to, you know, report to the Federal Election Commission about what they're doing. They could buy a lot more. And then you have Facebook deciding, again, who sees what, rather than, as he's pointing out, if you have a Facebook ad or a newspaper ad or a radio ad, you pretty much know that what you see is what you're going to get or what a certain number of people are going to get. Anyway, I think you're right, Dr. Epstein. That is the big story. We've been talking to Dr. Robert Epstein from San Diego. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. President Trump blasted Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Twitter this morning, saying that Sessions' decision to simply refer a FISA investigation to the Justice Department's Inspector General was disgraceful. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent. In 2002, was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from California by David Cobb, campaign manager of the 2016 Jill Stein Ajamu Baraka presidential campaign. David and Colleen, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Colleen, of course, Trump is angry. He's routinely angry at Jeff Sessions. I mean, there's a lot of reasons anybody could be angry at Jeff Sessions. But talk about this outburst from President Trump. Obviously, he doesn't want the inspector general in the FBI, who he says might be, quote, an Obama guy, to conduct the investigation over whether the FBI did something wrong when it made its representations to the FISA court about getting a warrant on a Carter Page, who had been previously a Trump campaign worker. Go ahead.
Well, I think Trump does have one point, and that is that when you refer something to the inspector general, that's internal affairs, and essentially they're only capable of finding administrative flaws. That means at the most negligent intent. Whereas if it had been referred to a criminal, you know, U.S. attorney or somebody in DOJ, they could actually then proceed on to maybe find criminal intent, which would at the very least be reckless, that those facts that were given to the FISA court were made recklessly. So he does have that point. On the other hand, as far as I know in history, even FBI agents who are found to have deliberately misled a regular criminal court are almost never, to my knowledge, ever found criminally responsible. At the most, civil liability would lie, but even usually that's never successful, trying to sue an FBI agent for even reckless misstatements in a warrant. In a regular criminal case, there would be a remedy, and that would be suppression of the evidence. And the good thing is, in regular criminal court, we wouldn't have the situation with this FISA where we wouldn't even know what the facts were, because all we have now are dueling memos. Because a defense attorney would do a motion for suppression, and a second court would then judge whether this FISA declaration was misleading or not. And so we wouldn't even have this situation if it wasn't for this secret, really, really wrong. There should be a way of appealing that FISA judgment to a FISA court of appeal. I think that would be the way to really resolve this.
And what you're talking about then, Colleen, just a quick follow-up, is not just about this instance, but about other instances as well. In other words, the FISA court isn't really a court. There's no adversarial element to the proceedings. The judge just more or less has to take the word of the intelligence agency in their representations. Is that what you mean, or do you mean about this instance?
Yes, and in fact, that's probably some of Sessions' thinking. He does not want the whole apparatus of the FISA court, the secret proceeding, which really, really contains a lot of flaws, and really, it's just an opportunity waiting for this kind of thing. If people were really to understand the FISA process, they would seek, at the very least, improvements to it. And probably that's another reason why Sessions really doesn't want to open up that can of worms. And so he gives it to the IG, hoping that that can tamp down a little bit and keep the public from really understanding the entire FISA process.
David Cobb, let me ask you about Donald Trump's tweet and see if you agree with Colleen Rulli. Here it is. Why is AG Jeff Sessions asking the Inspector General to investigate potentially massive FISA abuse? Will take forever, has no prosecutorial power, and already late with reports on Comey, et cetera. Isn't this IG an Obama guy? Why not use Justice Department lawyers? Disgraceful, in all caps, exclamation point. Anyway, let's get your take on it, David Cobb.
Well, Brian, first, let's acknowledge, Donald Trump is ripping Jeff Sessions, one of his earliest supporters, just as Donald Trump has basically ripped everybody. A lesson to be learned here is that ultimately Donald Trump turns on everybody, save so far direct family members, although stay tuned, that may be coming as well. I do want to take a step back. I think that Colleen's points are really powerful. Let's remember that FISA stands for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And this was created in order to oversee requests for surveillance against foreign spies inside the United States federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And, of course, it comes out of the U.S. Senate's Church Committee. You know me, Brian, I am rare to quote the New York Times favorably ever, understanding that to be an arm of the corporate state itself. But even the New York Times said that the entire FISA process, both the court and all of the apparatus, have become almost a secret parallel to the Supreme Court. So I think Colleen's points are dead on. If Trump made a point or two, it was just because he's swinging wildly. So let's take Donald Trump out of the critique and just recognize that we really do have an out-of-control deep state that ought to be critical, just as we have an out-of-control president, and we ought to be critical of that. So I refuse to get into either the Democratic versus Republican sort of narrative around this, and I want to be clear that as somebody on the left, I am absolutely suspicious of all things FBI and FISA, and I am equally critical of this plan.
All right. Colleen Rulli, I want to get your response to David in the next 2 minutes or so, and then Walter Smolarek is here, and I want to ask you, Walter, a little bit about the new revelations or the new announcements about Roger Stone and his communications with WikiLeaks. But go ahead, Colleen.
Well, I think that Trump's note that Horowitz, the inspector general, is a quote-unquote Obama guy was not correct. He actually seems to be nonpartisan. And the inspector general of the Department of Justice has always been independent and objective when it comes to the FBI. The reason is they're not in a hierarchical position. They're not in a situation with each other. So I think, as I said a long time ago, I would hope that the IG still can get to the bottom of it. And, if this FISA declaration was intentionally misleading, it does need to be corrected. And even Democrats at this point are going to have to get behind trying to fix that secret FISA process, because it is being misused, not only with Trump campaign, but on regular people, largely, of course, Muslims and people that they can claim are terrorist suspects, but increasingly anybody that they claim is, a traitor, etc.
Walter Smolarek, let's talk to one other part of this story, which is the media handling. This isn't this story. It's the story that's caught up with Russiagate, because all things now have an anchor with the Russiagate probe, so-called, which is not just the probe, not just Mueller's probe, but it's also the media report. Tell us the new news about the release of WikiLeaks private messages to Roger Stone. where they were telling Roger Stone, who was saying earlier that he had been the connection between WikiLeaks and the Trump administration, and the Democrats then said, thus the Russians, to the release of the DNC emails that WikiLeaks released in the summer of 2016.
Yeah, so it seems like Roger Stone has once again been exposed as somebody who is inflating his own importance in the world, in U.S. politics, you know, to raise his stock in the world. So a screen grab was released, a previously unreleased screen grab of a private conversation, private message conversation between WikiLeaks and Roger Stone. So this is a message from Stone. Since I was all over national TV, cable, and print defending WikiLeaks and Assange, you may want to re-examine the strategy of attacking me. He goes on, I'm skipping a couple parts, but you may want to re-examine the strategy of attacking me. And by that, what Stone meant was, hey, you're saying that we never had any type of correspondence, right? That's what WikiLeaks said about Roger Stone. And so WikiLeaks replied, we appreciate that. However, the false claims of association are being used by the Democrats to undermine the impact of our publications. Don't go there if you don't want us to correct you, basically saying, well, hey, you know, if you're going to go out there and present yourself as this big connection, we're under an obligation to say, well, that's not really true.
Again, this story is being twisted in by MSNBC and other media outlets who are saying these private texts between WikiLeaks and Roger Stone prior to the election show that there was a connection between Roger Stone and WikiLeaks, which WikiLeaks in the past had said there was no connection. He didn't have any impact on our release of the DNC documents. But if anything, the content of these tweets show the only connection that WikiLeaks was having with Roger Stone was telling him to shut up and stop lying about the fact that he had an association with WikiLeaks. I mean, that's pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it's important to look at the actual facts of the story before we just sort of make up our minds based on the headlines.
Okay. And of course, Roger Stone inserted himself as he does narcissistically as a self-promoter. But he became a big thing for the New York Times and the other mainstream media and before the House and Senate, before the Congress at least, about the so-called Russiagate investigation. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined by Colleen Raleigh, FBI whistleblower, and David Cobb, who was the campaign manager for the Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka 2016 presidential campaign, and in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is anything but democratic. President Joseph Kabila rules with an iron fist, warlords control swaths of the country's east, and inter-ethnic conflicts plague the cities. We're joined from Washington by Kambale Musavuli. He's the national spokesman for the Friends of the Congo, and he's one of that country's leading political and cultural voices. Kambale, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I think most Americans really don't know very much about the Congo. Can you tell us what the situation is like there right now?
Yeah, I mean, we do have a political crisis at the moment that's really geared toward the elections. And as in your introduction, you mentioned there is also the conflict in the East. But from your initial question about Americans not knowing, they may be driving a Tesla car. They may have those hybrid cars. Or different technology devices. But what they will not know is that minerals used to make those technological devices or cars come from the Congo. You know, cobalt is an essential mineral used in the electric cars and cell phone batteries. Congo is the number one producer of cobalt in the world today. Yet, the Congolese people don't benefit from it. And then we see a lawless situations where minerals are siphoned out of the country, and also leaders of the Congo are imposed by Western powers, specifically the United States. When we speak about even the political crisis today, we can't talk about the electoral crisis in the Congo without saying that in 2001, without the U.S. support, Joseph Kabila, the current president, wouldn't be in power today.
You know, this is such an important point, and this is something that I think every American should understand. You are exactly correct when you say that the country is very, very rich in terms of its natural resources. And these are natural resources that are used widely in U.S. manufacturing and all manufacturing, really. Used, for example, to make chrome that's used on automobiles, to make components for cell phones, as you said, cobalt. And the country does not benefit. The country is kept poor, really, by the Western countries that are taking the resources out of it. And this has led to violence.
Yes, I mean, the central question in the Congo is always, who's going to control Congo's resources and for whose benefit? And we've seen that in the history of the Congo from its modern-day founding in 1885, when there was the so-called Berlin Conference in Berlin to carve up the African continent. Congo was at the central discussion around the carving up of the continent. You know, Congo was given to King Leopold II, for access to rubber and ivory. Rubber, why? At the time, they needed the rubber for the vehicles, the tires of the cars and the bicycles and so on. In the 1960s, cobalt was again essential. When the Congolese people elected his first democratically elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, he was brutally assassinated with the help of the CIA and Western nation, specifically Belgium, and Congolese sycophants. After that, there was an imposition of a dictator for 32 years. Why? Access to cobalt again. Mobutu was in power until 1997, when he was toppled by a military coup or military uprising. But that military uprising was the United States supporting its African allies, specifically Rwanda and Uganda, who invaded the Congo twice in 96 and 98. And through this invasion, as we talk about the crisis, the how people are facing this crisis, 6 million Congolese people have died since 1996, and the numbers continues. While the minerals still find its way out, the Congolese people are still at the bottom of the Human Development Index, while they see the country continue to plunge to war and crisis.
We're speaking with Kambale Musavuli. He's the national spokesman for the Friends of the Congo, and he is one of the Congo's leading political and cultural voices. We're talking about the economics behind the violence that we're seeing in the Congo, and it's really all over the country. It comes down to the issue of natural resources and the natural resources that are essentially being stolen from that country. Brian, would you agree?
Yeah, and I want to talk about the regional players and their relationship to the Western countries, especially Rwanda and Uganda and their links to the violence with the militias in the eastern part of the country, a very mineral-rich part of Congo. And just to go back for people who might not know what Kambale was saying is that there was a conference in Berlin in 1884. All the European powers were there, the West European powers, and the United States was there as an observer. And they took the map of Africa and they drew which country, which of the colonial powers was going to take which part of Africa. And within 18 years after the Berlin Conference, by 1902, almost all evidence of African self-governance had been destroyed. Within 20 years, perhaps with the exception of Ethiopia. And during that entire time, as a consequence of that Congress, the claims made by King Leopold II from Little Belgium on this great vast Congo were recognized as valid. And so then you have the Congolese people rising up in an anti-colonial movement for justice and for independence and for sovereignty, led by Patrice Lumumba. And Lumumba becomes the target of the CIA and Western intelligence and, of course, Belgium, and brutally assassinated. And we can't really, you know, one of the sort of dire and I would say stereotypical and racist images is that the problem of African governance in Congo or elsewhere is a consequence of failures domestically and locally. But it's not possible, Kambale, for anyone to understand anything about the Congo without putting Congo in an international and in a regional context. Talk about the regional context, if you would.
And thank you for really framing it well, because as I mentioned earlier, that the situation today is tied to the direct history of Western interference, specifically the United States. But Congo is a huge country. It's the size of Western Europe. It's bordered by 9 African countries. In the east, it has Rwanda and Uganda as its neighbors. But the United States has use Rwanda and Uganda as its allies on the war on terror. So right now you will find Ugandan soldiers in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Ugandan soldiers, actually, Rwanda soldiers there in Haiti, Mali, and many different African countries, mainly serving U.S. interests in military operations. As you see them as allies, they have not had any form of pressure to end their invasions of the DRC. They've, as I mentioned earlier, they invaded the Congo twice, in 96 and 98, and have unleashed the deaths of millions of Congolese, estimated at 5.4 million in some of the reports. We will never know. But what's critical to know, even though I'm making these claims, that these are claims that have been documented by United Nations, many reports. In 2010, the United Nations published a report called the UN Mapping Exercise Report, calling what's happening in the Congo war crimes, crimes against humanity, and potential genocide if proven in a competent court. This is during the time where Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, and she pretty much buried that report. The United States never took any action to hold perpetrators of violence in the Congo accountable up until today. And this is why we appeal to the world to see the situation. While say all these atrocities taking place, it's also critical to mention that Congolese are not sitting idly by waiting for justice. They're also fighting on the ground, just as the youth movement in the 1960s brought independence to African nations. Right now, young Congolese and clergy in the Congo are leading the charge in demanding accountability for local leaders, yet at the same time as they are demanding justice and accountability, we see regional players also influencing Congolese politics. Some Western nations, we see France and Spain supporting the Kabila regime that's exploiting the people. And on the African continent, at the moment, Rwanda, Zambia, and South Africa are still also supporting the Kabila regime. But I'm still very fearful. If young people in 1960 could gain independence, right, while they were facing Belgian paratroopers, they were facing mass atrocities by the Belgian forces, but they were able to succeed. At this time, witnessing the courage of young Congolese who are putting their lives on the line any day they come out in the street, I'm very confident that they will succeed. And it's important to lift up their stories around the resistance they are waging on the ground so that the world know that this is happening. And so support can come to them and they feel that they are not alone in the struggle inside of the Congo.
Kambale, we have just about 30 seconds left. I want to ask for a quick comment from you on how the advent of AFRICOM, the U.S. military's Africa Command, has had an impact on Congo. Has there been any impact?
Yes. I mean, AFRICOM is operating across the continent, even in the DRC. American soldiers have been training also Congolese military. We've seen actually some of them in action during the M23 rebellion in 2012. I mean, let's be very clear. Africa needs a lot of things, and the last thing that they need is a military. So seeing the United States military on the African continent does not address the needs of African people.
It addresses the needs of, or the perceived needs of the American people, but not the the Congolese people. I apologize that we have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Kambale Musavuli. He's the national spokesman for the Friends of the Congo, and he's one of the Congo's leading political and cultural voices.
We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us in the Washington, D.C. area every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can subscribe to us at an iTunes podcast. And you can listen to us every day at SputnikNews.com. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.